great pleasure to introduce Jim Mallinson, who has done a lot of work on what he's going to talk about today, on the early history of yoga. He did the curriculum of the Kecheri Vidya and has been a translator for the Clay Sanskrit Library, that seems to have disappeared. And today he's talking about
Vaishnavism and Hatha Yoga. Thanks very much, Rembert, and thanks everyone for coming. I'm talking about Vaishnavism and Hatha Yoga, but to start off with, I'll try and put the subject in a bit of context. And some of you, I think certainly Sanjukta was here, I think it was probably 3 years ago now, that I gave a couple of talks about the Nath Sampradaya and early Hatha Yoga. And by early Hatha Yoga, I mean that variety of yoga which puts emphasis on physical techniques. Now, until recently, scholarship on yoga, my own included, has declared Hatha Yoga to be a reformation of Tantric Yoga introduced by the gurus of the Nath Sampradaya, in particular their supposed founder, Gorakṣa. And in much secondary literature, the phrases Nath Yoga and Hatha Yoga are used interchangeably. And when other traditions are seen to employ the practices or terminology of Hatha Yoga, they are said to be borrowing from the Naths. So now to get quickly onto the topic and to give you an excuse to show some slides straight away. How do we do this?
F5.
So I want to give you an example of how one of the ascetic orders of today, amongst whom we do find practitioners of Hatha Yoga, is the Ramanandi Sampradaya. And this chap, Rembert, mentioned my DPhil thesis, which was an edition of a text called the Kecheri Vidya. So I went to try and find people who still did the central practice of the text, this Kecheri Mudra, and this was the first sadhu that I found. It's called Parasuram Dasji, up in Kulu. He deigned after much persuasion. He showed it off to me. And then I've got another slide here. Here's another. This is more recent. That last picture was 1995, and this is a couple of years ago at the Kumbh Mela in Haridwar. Again, another Ramanandi sadhu. But then an example of how people always assume that Hatha Yoga has come from the Naths, as Peter van der Veer wrote an ethnography of the Ramanandis back in the 80s, in which, because of, among other things, their practice of what he calls Tantric Yoga, he says that these Ramanandi Tyagis are deeply influenced by the Tantric community of the Nath Yogis. Now, in a paper I gave at the conference organised by this centre on Shakta traditions in September last year, I showed how the Naths should not be credited with being the innovators of Hatha Yoga, but that what I call classical Hatha Yoga, i.e. the Hatha Yoga taught in the Hatha Pradipika and most of the subsequent texts that deal with the subject, is the result of an overlay of Nath Tantric Yoga onto an older ascetic Hatha Yoga, elements of which have been practiced from at least the time of the Buddha. In fact, I argued that the origins of the practices of Hatha Yoga should not be looked for in early formulations of the almost purely mental yoga taught in the Yoga Sutra and elsewhere, but in the physical techniques of tapas. I also showed that the practitioners of this original Hatha Yoga were ascetics, probably for the most part outside of Vedic orthodoxy, and that their tradition is best represented today by the Ramanandi Tyagis and also the Dasnami Sannyasis. I'll come on to these two orders. The Ramanandi Tyagis and the Dasnami Sannyasis, they're found all over India, although they're not particularly well represented in the south, and they're the two biggest ascetic orders in India today. They number probably in the hundreds of thousands, but it's very difficult to get accurate figures. And then at these Kumbh Melas, which happen every 3 years, they make up the bulk of the main part of the camps that are there. And the organisation of those sadhu camps at the Kumbh Melas is the result of a history of military encounters between the various akharas, or regiments of sadhus. These encounters were at their most frequent and bloody in the 18th century, when the sadhu orders flourished in the power vacuum that existed as the Mughal Empire fizzled out and the British struggled to win control of North India. And through control of pilgrimage and trade routes and through hiring out their services as mercenaries, some lineages of these sadhus, they became extremely rich and powerful. Now, during this period, the relatively homogeneous ascetic soup that had happily existed for hundreds of years solidified into different sampradayas. Before that, there didn't seem to be so much emphasis on different lineages, different traditions. It's only then that this kind of corporate identity of the various ascetic orders becomes very definite. And then when the British took control of the Mela in the early 19th century, the organisation of these orders became fixed and has changed very little since. And the main organisational principle is a division into two, which is known as the Ram Dal and the Shiv Dal, simply the armies of Ram and the armies of Shiva. The first, in fact, includes a variety of Vaishnava orders under the rubric of the Char Sampradaya, or the four traditions. But it's the military wing of the Ramanandis that was and is now still numerically the strongest, hence the name Ram Dal. And the latter, the Shiv Dal, corresponds to the Dasanami Naga Sannyasis. And I've got a picture here. This is on their, you know, their parade on one of the main bathing days of the Kumbh Mela. You know, one of these pictures that every 3 years they seem to crop up on the front of the newspapers and the TV get beamed around because these naked guys are going for a bath. But because of their historical animosity, the two camps of the Ram Dal and the Shiv Dal are separated, sometimes miles apart in Nasik and Haridwar. They're a long way apart because of historical animosity between them, and fighting used to break out, although it hasn't happened for a couple of hundred years now. Okay, now this picture shows a few of the attributes of ascetics attested since the time of the Buddha, and found in tandem with the forerunners of the practices of Hatha Yoga in our earlier textual description. So they're naked, they're covered in ash, they've got jata, long matted hair, and there's one fella, he's got his arm up in the air, which it looks pretty sort of withered, so I guess he's been doing that for quite a long time. You know, all these practices are found together in our earlier sources. I've got another one here. So here's a Ramanandi, in fact, practicing another of these ancient austerities. He's also a yogi, although he called himself a yogi, but how he does much of what we would recognise as yoga without sitting down, I'm not quite sure. But he was sort of well on his way into a 12-year stint of staying standing. And here's another of a Ramanandi, again practicing again the ancient austerity of sitting surrounded by fire. In our older sources, it's generally called Panchagni Tapas. These Ramanandis have developed it rather more so that it's an 18-year course, and this sadhu's in the last section. That 6 3-year parts to the course is the last one where they put fire on their heads as well. And then a few of them at the end of doing this, they sit surrounded by fire, and they only do it in summer. They will have just started Basant Panchami, and they go on till the monsoon for 4 months, and they do it in the middle of the day, under the heat of the summer sun. But often at the end, well, not often. There's only a few of them, but some of them will do some what we'd recognise as Hatha yogic asanas. Okay, so after that brief bit of scene setting, I want to turn to the handout. The very first text to teach practices of Hatha yoga is a text, it's probably from the 13th century or so, called the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, which I put together an edition of. I've edited it from 6 or 7 manuscripts, and lucky enough to read it this term with Jason, Peter and Andrea and Alexis Sanderson. So we've made lots of improvements to it, even though actually by the standards of yoga texts it's in reasonably good state. Anyway, I'm going to read this first passage, the first item on the handout, which is where Hatha Yoga is introduced. So this is the first text, this is the earliest instance we have of Hatha Yoga being introduced and then explained as to what its techniques are. So we've got, it's just come after the practice, the teachings of Laya Yoga, which is what I spoke about quite a lot in September, which was this sort of visualization of Kundalini, these more meditational practices. And then it moves on to, in the hierarchy in this text, the best yoga is this Hatha Yoga. So, sa eva Laya Yoga hasyad, Hatha Yogam Tataha Srinu. Yamascha Niyamaschaiva, Asanam Cha Tataha Param, Pranayamascha Chaturtaha Syat, Pratyaharas Tu Panchamaha, Tatastu Dharana Prokta, Dhyanam Saptamam Uchite, Samadhir Ashtamaha Proktaha, Sarva Punya Pala Pradaha. Evam Ashtanga Yogam Cha Yagya Valkyadayo Viduhu. So first of all, it's introduced as the eight limbs of yoga as taught in the Yoga Sutra and elsewhere, early text of Patanjali. And it's said that this eightfold yoga was known by Yajnavalkya and others. And later on in the text, this type of Hatha Yoga is called the Kavi Marga, the way of the seers. It's associated with these more Vedic orthodox rishis. But then it goes on to say, Kapiladyastu siddhascha hartam kuryas tatonyatha, tadyatacha mahamudra mahabandhas tataivacha, tatahasyat kechri mudra bandho jalandras tatha, udhyanam mulabandho viparita kratis tatha, bajrolir amarolischa sahajolis tridha utha. So, and after that says, but Kapila and other siddhas, they practiced, or we've got kuryas, which is an optative, but I think we have to take it as a past tense here, a perfect, they practiced hatha tatonyata, differently from that, in a different fashion. And then it lists these 10 physical practices, which are known as mudras or bandhas, and they do, in various ways, sort of pneumatically, mechanically, they're said to work on the breath, moving the breath into the central channel and raising it up, and also either by doing that or through other means preserving bindu up in the head, which is equated with semen and is the principle of life, the vital principle, which needs to be preserved because otherwise it gets wasted and then you die. So we have these two different sorts of practice. The second lot, this is the first time this alternative type of hatha gets introduced, so we can see this as a sort of distinguishing feature of hatha yoga in its first textual formulations. Now, when I gave the two talks here in 2009, I discussed this text, so I hope I'm not going over too much old ground for people, but in particular I dwelt on a passage which indicates the milieu in which the text was composed. It's the next item on your handout. It's a list of the religious practices and insignia which do not lead to success unless they are accompanied by the practice of yoga. So I'm going to go through that one again as well. Mundito dandadhari va kashaya vasanopi va. So if you're mundita, shaven-headed, dandadhari, carrying a stick, kashaya vasano, if you've got orange clothes, ochre robes, Narayana Vadovapi Jatilo Bhasmalepanaha, or if you say Narayana, if you have Jata, matted hair, if you cover your body in ash, Namaha Shivaya Va Chiva Bahyaracha Pujakopi Va, if you say Namaha Shivaya, if you worship external images, icons, Archa, Sthana Dwadasha Pujo Va, or if you worship at the 12 places, I'm going to come back to this in a minute, or Malabhir Bahubhushitaha, if you're wearing lots of malas, I think there's some alternative readings for that, but that seems to be the best. If you do all of these things, but Kriyahino, if you do not practice, if you are devoid of practice, or you are Krura, you're cruel, i.e., I think the implication is you practice, you sacrifice animals or something like that, Katam Siddhim Avapniyat, how are you going to... How is one to obtain siddhi? How is one to get success? Before I gave that last lecture, I was convinced that this text, the Dattatreya Yogashastra, was the product of forerunners of one of these, the suborders of the Shaiva Dasanami Sannyasis, the naked Nagas, who I just showed some slides of. And various features of the text supported this conviction. The main points are its teachings of Hatha Yoga, which the Dasanamis still do, and of course the text being the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra, the yoga teachings of Dattatreya, because Dattatreya is the Ishtadevata, the main god of the Juna Akara, which is the biggest of the Dasanamis regiments. this passage seemed to confirm the implications of those bigger clues, because all these epithets can apply to them. But Dr. Gupta here, Sanjukta, pointed out at the end of the talk that actually Sthana Dwadasha Puja, which I had taken to mean worshipping at the 12 places, so the 12 Jyotirling shrines of Shiva around India, Dr. Gupta said that it was more likely to refer to applying to worshipping at the 12 places on the body, i.e. applying the 12 the Urdhva Pundras, the Vaishnava markings, often seen on the forehead. You can probably see them in this picture, actually. The one in the front is sort of sweated most of his off, but you see those markings there. And then, and at first I was somewhat sceptical, so fixed in my conviction was I that this was a Dasnami text. A Dasnami, by the way, those of you who don't know, means 10 names. It's divided into 10 different lineages, of which the Giris and the Puris, who form that kind of naked warrior sect or subsect that I showed you earlier. Anyway, I soon realised that Sanjukta was, of course, absolutely right, because various reasons, not least because recent research has shown that this concept of the 12 Jyotirlings didn't even exist at the time of the composition of this text, I think. And then also in the course of collating further manuscripts, as you'll see, and there's a little note there, there's a reading Pundro for in one of the manuscripts instead of Puja, which I have now adopted in the edition. I just wanted to show it to you like this. But what really confirmed my mistake was my realization that, blinkered by this idea that it was the product of the Dasnamis, I had been completely overlooking the fact that the text is clearly Vaishnava, and the clues were staring me in the face. Dattatreya himself has long been associated with Vishnu. I think I've got a slide here. Yeah. Now, this is the sort of modern iconography of Dattatreya. He's normally shown with the Trimurti. But he's actually included in among the 38 Vibhavas, the emanations of Vishnu, taught in the Satvata Sanghita, which is one of the earliest Pancharatrika texts, and then in subsequent texts too. He's among the 23 avatars of Vishnu taught in the Bhagavata Purana. And then, you know, really blatant clues such as the opening and closing verses, which are here in the handout again. The first verse, Nrsingha Rupine Chidatmane Sukhaswarupine Padaistribhistadadivir Nirupitaya Vayat Namaha. So I homage to he who has the form of Narsing in the first line, i.e. the Narsing incarnation of Vishnu, and then the other epithets are Vedantic epithets. And then the last verse, the last line of the last verse, Dattatreyasya Vishnoho Pada Nalina Yugam Nityameva Prabhadye. I constantly worship the two lotus feet of Vishnu as Dattatreya, or Vishnu Dattatreya. So this awakening to the Vaishnava nature of the text led me to reassess who had produced it. And if we look here, this is a picture of a Ramanandi applying the 12 tilaks. Because the Ramanandis, actually there's a division amongst them. They trace their lineage back to what's known as the Sri Sampradaya of Ramanuja. And so this tradition of 12 tilaks, again, is very old. It's found in Pancharatrika Sanghitas. But then there's been a long-running dispute within this sect between whether they should affiliate themselves to the supposedly more Brahmanical Ramanuja. And so actually the ones who are more inclined towards Ramanand will only apply 5 tilaks. But here's one of them applying 12 tilaks, or Urdhva Pundras. And the Ramanandis are also perfectly open to the worship of Dattatreya. I've been to various Dattatreya temples where the priests are Ramanandis. But there's no mention of Rama, who's obviously their Ishtadevata, in the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra. But I think because of this connection with Ramanuja, whose southern Sri Vaishnava tradition has Vishnu Narayana as its godhead, this suggested to me that was the milieu in which the text might have been produced. But then, not long after the lecture, I was looking through my collection of slides, of scans of medieval miniatures of ascetics, returning, as I often do, to this deservedly well-known depiction of a famous battle between two groups of ascetics that happened at a place called Thanesar, which is, well, I think it probably happened at Kurukshetra, the same place, in 1567. Now, the reason we've got two pictures of it, from the Akbarnama, because the fight was witnessed by Akbar. In fact, what happens, it says in the story, that and the two sides in the battle are identified as Giris and Puris, two of these Dasnami suborders. And I think it was I can't remember which way around. I think the Giris were very much outnumbered, and so Akbar, for all his tolerance and enjoyment of things Hindu, sent in some of his troops to help the Giris or whoever was outnumbered, because he wanted the sport to continue, and they did then win. They defeated the Puris, and everyone seemed to enjoy the spectacle, probably apart from the people taking part. But to get back to my point, if we look closely at the combatants on both sides, I'm zooming in here, I'm not sure how clear it is, but they've all got Vaishnava tilaks, Urdhva Pundras. Can you see? On their foreheads, you can see they've got this U-shaped, rather than the supposedly, you know, these guys are classically meant to be Shaiva, but none of them have got the Shaiva markings on them. Now, it might be argued that this painting, because it does date to about 25 years after the event, is artistic license. But there's another picture of the same event. This is in a different manuscript of the Akbarnama in Patna, which Professor Vijay Pinch kindly sent me scans of. And again, if we zoom in, I think you can see they've all got these Vaishnava tilaks on, Urdhva Pundras. And also, these Mughal miniatures are famous. I'm no art historian, I'm really slightly out of my depth, but they are famous for the accuracy of their depiction of the life at that time. I got held up, apparently the word is they're very naturalistic. I tried saying realistic, but art historians say they're extremely naturalistic. And I can certainly attest that, because I have looked at a lot of these miniatures now, more of the Narts, actually. There's lots of, some dating from this period and then slightly later, of Nart yogis, and the consistency between the different depictions is striking and incredibly accurate. So, you know, I think this is a significant bit of information. And also we have further pictorial evidence. There's this rather wonderful picture, I think, from this. My attention was drawn to this by Dr. Deborah Diamond in Washington. It's a painting of an ascetic encampment. It's in an album called the St. Petersburg Muraka. And this painting itself was painted by an artist called Mir Said Ali in about 1565, apparently. And unlike the Taneser picture, we don't have any. By the way, that last picture is in the Victorian Albert Museum. But this one, we don't have any sort of text to go with it. We've got no information about the picture. But the similarities with a Dasnami Naga camp today are really quite striking. They look really very, very similar. And it's wonderful. It's quite hard to see from here, but there's so much going on. You can see the top right, the stores are arriving, someone's making a note in the ledger, and then they're doing all the cooking there on the far right. They've got their camels, someone's milking the goats. Down in the bottom left, you can see they're all they're sieving bung. They're going to be drinking some bung, so that hasn't changed much, except nowadays they'll be smoking a bit more probably, because this is before smoking had taken off, tobacco hadn't arrived. But anyway, and you see this, there's one there, some of them are naked, some of them are wearing ochre robes. To get back on topic, if you zoom right in at the Mahant, the main figure in the middle, who's meeting this nobleman or whatever, again he's got a Vaishnava tilak. So I mean, it might be argued that these are forerunners of Ramanandis, and they may be. I'm slightly getting into foggy territory here, because I'm kind of rethinking how the Ramanandis formed at the moment. I have suspicions that they were extremely close, if not one and the same, as these forerunners of the Dasnamis. But there are significant differences. For example, they will only wear white cloth, the Ramanandis. They won't go naked. And they won't do... There's a division in who'll do what austerities, and they won't do this arms-in-the-air thing, because it normally permanently disfigures the body. They'll happily stand up for 12 years, because then normally you can sit down again and you're fine. But because the one significant difference between Ramanandis and these Dasnamis is that they when they're initiated, they don't cut off their choti, so they retain the right to perform Vedic rituals. That which is why they won't disfigure the body. They want the body has to be perfect and whole in order to perform Vedic rituals. And I got a couple of pictures here. Actually, this guy's these days. He's always sitting outside the Juna Arkana at the. He's a Dasnam. He's always at the Kumbh Mela. And then there's this amazing figure on the left here, who's written about in one of the earliest issues of Asiatic Researches. And he travelled with both arms in the air. It seems they've got a bit sort of soft now, because no one seems to do the two-arm one anymore. I can only put one arm. But he got as far as a British officer interviewed him, wrote down his life story, and he got to Baku in Azerbaijan, Moscow, then over to Tibet, then down to Burma, Sri Lanka, all with both arms up in the air. And this is at the end of the 18th century. Okay, but the point is that they're all... Dasnamis. He's called Puran Puri. That other fellow is a Puri. I can't remember his first name. So it's only the Dasnamis that do that practice. But anyway, these Vaishnava Tilaks, this sort of apparent Vaishnavism of the Dasnamis got me thinking about them. And I realised that in fact the Vaishnava features of the Dasnamis are legion. So many that there's not enough time for me to go through them all now, but I'll just note some of the more important ones. First of all, there's... I mentioned how Dattatreya is a Vibhava of Vishnu, and there's an old connection between him as being identified with Vishnu. And this is the central shrine of the Dasnami Juna Akala in Haridwar. So that's the Dattatreya, I'm afraid it's spelt wrong up there, Charan Paduka. And then similarly, the second biggest order, the Mahanirvani Akala, their Ishtadevata is Kapila. Who is again one of these emanations of Vishnu. And as we saw here in the first part of the handout, he is credited with being the originator of these alternative practices of Hatha Yoga. What else? When the Dasnamis meet each other, they say Om Namo Narayan. I'm afraid they don't say Narayanaya, they say Narayan, but that's the ancient, very, very old, very well attested Ashtakshara salutation said by Vaishnavas. And then three of the four Dasnami Pitas are at Vaishnava Pitas. We've got Badrinath, Dwarka, and Puri. And then the fourth is Sringeri in the south, which is Smarta but predominantly Shaiva. And I suspect, although it's still not clear, that may be where, I think the south is where the Shaivaness of these Dasnamis came from. And then Shankara himself, their supposed founder, he was more Vaishnava than Shaiva. And finally, the notes here, the nominal suffix Puri that their main suborder is known by. As far as I know, and I'm expecting people here will know more about this than I do, but it's only found in the name of Vaishnavas prior to the 16th century. So there's Ishwara Puri, who was Chaitanya's mantra guru. And then similarly, the term Gosai or Goswami, it came to refer predominantly to Shaiva Dasnamis, but prior to the 16th century or so, it was only used for Vaishnava ascetics. Okay, so this evidence has convinced me that the Naga suborders of the Dasnamis were originally Vaishnava, and it worries me slightly, and I think I should probably be keeping it under my hat, because I don't want to be proclaiming this on my next foray into the camp of the Shiv Dal at the Kumbh Mela. But to get back to my main point, the textual evidence suggests that Hatha Yoga was practiced by Vaishnavas from the time of its earliest textual formulation. And this apparent Vaishnava lineage seems to suggest who was doing it, that these were the people that were doing it. But there is strong evidence that the practices of Hatha Yoga were used by Shaivas too. Although I want to add here that I don't find any evidence of their having been used in the Mantra Marga Shaivism, in which they are often said to have originated. But most obviously there are the names of the mudras that were listed here. You know, there's Jalandhara Bandha, Uddiyana Bandha, so they're named after these two Shaiva Pitas. There's Mahamudra, Mahaveda, Vajroli, Sahajoli, Amaroli, Khichri Mudra, so they're all extremely redolent of Shaivism. And Mahamudra is said in the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra to have been taught by Bhairava. And the text itself is extremely anti-sectarian. Despite it being a Vaishnava text, it's very universalist. I think if we look at item number 5 on the handout, it illustrates this. Brahmanah shramano vapi baudho vapi arhatotava kapalako va charvakaha shradhaya sahitaha sudhihi yoga abhyasa rato nityam sarvasiddhim avapnuyat. So whether a Brahmin or an ascetic or a Buddhist or a Jain or a kapalika, a skull bearer, a charvaka, a materialist, if he's a wise man, sudhihi, endowed with shraddha, faith or conviction, and is constantly devoted to the practice of yoga, he may obtain complete success. Okay. So I would rather suggest that the techniques of early Hatha Yoga originated as practices used by celibate ascetics of a variety of traditions, and that they were used to complement their accumulation of power through tapas. I would also argue that this ascetic tradition is where the non-seated asanas that have become emblematic of Hatha Yoga are first found. In the epics and early Buddhist sources, we hear of ascetics holding difficult positions for long periods of time. The nature of some of them is clear. There are ascetics who stand up for years on end, sometimes on one leg, like we saw in the picture, or ascetics are often said to be upside down. Sometimes in the Pali canon they talk of the Vaguli Vata, so the bat penance, so hanging from a tree like a bat. Other times they don't say that, they just say with the head downwards, so it's not clear exactly how. But and they are also said to adopt postures whose exact nature is not clear. The Pali canon includes 4 instances of descriptions of ascetics in something called Utkutika Padana, which appears to be some sort of squatting position, so it's from Utkatasana we find, not just in yoga texts, but the squatting position. And we also find a variety of early references to ascetics in Virasana, the heroic posture, whose nature, again, is not specified, but it comes in long lists of very uncomfortable things, like sleeping on the ground, staying outside, so it's probably not very comfortable. That's all we can, I think, infer. Now, in contrast to the mudra and bandha techniques of early formulations of Hatha Yoga, the textual evidence for these non-seated asanas does suggest that they are more strongly connected with Vaishnava traditions. The starting point for most of my research on early Hatha Yoga has been the Hatha Pradipika, which is in the main a compilation of passages from earlier texts that was put together by Swatmarama in the 15th century. Now, it's in the Hatha Pradipika that non-seated asanas are first taught under the rubric of Hatha Yoga. And of the 15 asanas taught in the Hatha Pradipika, 8 are relatively simple seated postures for meditation, such as those taught in a wide variety of earlier texts, including Vyasa's Bhashya on the Yoga Sutra, and a large number of Shaiva Tantras, starting from the earliest that we have, the 5th century or thereabouts, Nishwasa Tattva Sanghita, and several Puranas. Now, of the 7 non-seated asanas, one is Shavasana, the corpse pose, which is a reworking of a posture taught as a technique of Laya Yoga, which I mentioned earlier. So it's more a meditative technique taught in the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra. And another, Paschimottanasana, is taught in the Shiva Sanghita, which was composed not long before the Hatha Pradipika. And I have failed to identify source passages for 3 of the non-seated asanas taught in the Hatha Pradipika, namely Uttana Kurmaka, Dhanur and Matsyendra asanas. But the verses describing the remaining 2, Kukuta and Mayura asana, so the cock and the peacock, are taken from the Vasishta Sanghita, which is a circa 13th or 14th century Vaishnava work. Its Vaishnavism is not overt. The text teaches Vedantic philosophy in its attempt to incorporate yoga within an orthodox Vedic ritual framework, but the Saguna Dhyana that it teaches is of Vishnu Narayana. Now, its teachings on Mayurasana are also found in earlier Pancharatrika works. Now, the oldest is the circa 10th or 11th century Vimanarchana Kalpa, which I think is part of the Marichi Sanghita, and it's a Vaikanasa Sanghita, and it teaches the peacock pose, the Mayurasana, as one of the lowest of 3 grades of asana. So this passage is on the handout, number 5. Now, if we look at it, I've listed 5 different, a progression of verses teaching it. I won't go through them in detail, but The vocabulary, the words used are almost identical in every one, but we can see a progression from the prose passage of the Vimana Archana Kalpa through the shlokas of the Yogapada of the Padma Sanghita, Ahirabhudna Sanghita, and Vasishta Sanghita, the Yoga Kanda, and the Yoga Yajnavalkya. And then finally in the Hatha-Pradipika, the same verses, the same words are reworked into a couple of Upajati verses. And then the Kukutasana. Actually, sorry, I did have a slide.
Here
we go. So I did have a slide to bring up. That's the Peacock Mayur Asana. And this is...
Kukutasana also.
Yeah, here we are, back to the same one, yeah, the same Kukutasana. Now, that it's not taught in the Vimana Archana Kalpa or the Padma Sanghita or the Yoga Yajnavalkya, but the verses describing it in the Hatha-Pradipika are found in the Ahiribhudna Sanghita and Vasishta Sanghita, in very similar verses, and again, these are on your handout. Now, on its own, this evidence wouldn't point to very much. All we could say is that the oldest textual evidence for non-seated asanas being included in the rubric of hatha or of yoga. But yeah, this is where they're for. Obviously, we get these earlier descriptions of ascetics standing up or hanging upside down, but this is always said to be tapas. It's not said to be yoga. So this is the first time we get these strange postures or difficult non-seated postures being called asanas of yoga. So what makes these Vaishnava passages more significant is that the 13th century Matsyendra Sanghita, a compendium of teachings attributed to Matsyendra, one of the founding gurus of the Natha Sampradaya, also includes Mayura and Kukuta asanas among the 14 asanas it teaches, all of which are seated postures. Now, the text of both of these is reproduced here in number 7 on the handout. Now, the descriptions are pretty obscure, and the text is somewhat corrupt. I won't try and make absolute sense of it. Maybe it's best... Well, I've got Kshaba's... the edition is by Kshaba Kiss, who edited the text with Alexis Anderson for his DPhil a few years ago. And I've got his attempt at a translation, but I think we can pretty clearly conclude that they're different. It's a different posture from these separate Mayura and Kukuta asanas, and that they're seated postures as well. I don't think I'll try and make sense of it. Just please take my word for it. If you want to know more, I can show you Shabba's attempt at translation afterwards. But what this shows is that there was a Vaishnava tradition of non-seated asanas prior to a Nath tradition, and what's more, that it was the Vaishnava tradition that was adopted in the Nath, or at least the Siddha text that was the Hatha-Pradipika. Still got a bit of time. I'm going to wind up by tracing a few more. I think that's it for the handout, isn't it? Yeah. I'm going to trace a few more connections between Hatha Yoga as practiced today and in its earlier sources, and also just to start by looking at some of the texts of the later medieval period. So I know of no manuals of Hatha Yoga by Naths from after the time of the Hatha-Pradipika. There is one Nath text which does mention some Hatha Yogic practices, the Siddha Siddhanta Padati, which was probably written around 1700, I think, or 17th century. But that text is more a statement of the Nath Sampradaya's metaphysics than a manual of Hatha Yoga. Meanwhile, there is a wealth of new texts on Hatha Yoga composed in the course of the 16th to 19th centuries, new writings, compendia, commentaries, and vernacular works. Many of the Sanskrit works are the products of Brahmin Shastris, but some were also written by Dasnami or Sri Vaishnava scholars. That doesn't preclude them from being Brahmins, but we can identify them as specifically Dasnami or Sri Vaishnava. We've got, for example, the 16th century Yoga Chintamani of Shivananda and the 19th century Hatha Pradipika Jyotsna of Brahmananda. There aren't the Ananda suffixes on their name, suggesting that they were possibly sannyasis. And more clearly, Vaishnava are the Yoga Marga Prakashika of Yugaladasa, his name being a giveaway, and the Raja Yoga ascribed to Agastya. The latter two texts both include invocations to Ramanuja in their Mangala verses. I'm grateful to Peter and Jason for typing both of those in, which is how I know that. the only vernacular manuals of Hatha Yoga composed in the pre-modern period of which I'm aware, well, actually in the south, there's the Tamil Tirumantharam, whose date is rather a political and scholarly hot potato, but probably not much earlier than the 12th or 13th century. That has a few Hatha practices, and then there's the Gyaneshwari of Sant Gyandev, which was written at the end of the 13th century in Marathi. And then in the north, the only texts I'm aware of are the... the Tirumantharam is very much a Shaiva text. Again, adding to my suspicions that the Shaivism of this whole body of thought and practice comes from the south. In the north vernacular text, we've got the third Ulasa of a text called the Gyana Samudra by the 17th century Dadu Panti scholar Sundara Dasa, so he's a Vaishnava. And the same author wrote a work, a kind of doxography of yoga called the Sarvanga Yoga Pradipika. And then in 1734, a Ramanandi called Jayatarama wrote a text in Braj Bhasha. All these texts are in Braj Bhasha, called the Jog Pradipika. Now, I've recently been collaborating with a scholar of Arabic and Persian called Professor Karl Ernst, and he specializes in Sufi traditions. And he's for a long time has been working on a cycle of texts, supposedly based on a Sanskrit work called the Amrita Kunda, but I'm pretty sure that never existed. But there are all these Persian and Arabic texts which are said to be translations of it. He's been looking in particularly recently at a text called the Bahr al-Hayat, the Water of Life, so it's a similar calque of Amrita Kunda. The reason I've got involved is because it's, I'll show you here, it's got a manuscript of it dating to 1603, has got 21 illustrations of asanas in it, and it's going to be shown as a big exhibition of yoga-related art being organised by Deborah Diamond, who I mentioned earlier, that's happening at the Sackler Gallery late next year. And they're going to put on show all of these pictures of asanas. And as far as I'm aware, these are the earliest depictions or paintings of non-seated asanas. We do get some sculptures from about 1500 on the Prakara wall of the Sri Shailam temple in Andhra Pradesh. Now, by coincidence, while I was trying to help Carl identify some of these asanas, because they do have, the text tries to, you know, reproduces various Indic words, but they're very hard to identify, you know, not least because there aren't many vowels around. I was sort of rather clutching at straws. And then Jason was having a dialogue with Peter, or email that I was CC'd in, and about the colophon of a text called the Yoga Chintamani. So I started looking at it and I started reading on, and it has a section on asanas. And then suddenly I realized that this manuscript, that one of the ones that was being discussed, had an extra passage on asanas, and the manuscript was copied in 1660. And there were seven extra in this interpolated, or this extra passage, and they correspond directly to the ones in this in this Water of Life, the Bahr al-Hayat. So this one is called the Shunyasana. We're looking at the picture and looking at the Carl's translation of the Persian, just made no sense at all. You know, what are the toes doing on the elbows? But then sure enough, in the Sanskrit it says the same thing as well. So they obviously, you know, and it's very interesting with all 21, the way, well, in particular these seven, but the way that we can now, you know, the Sanskrit sheds light on the Persian and vice versa, and then the pictures. But sorry, I'm really getting off topic here. Get back on topic. In this 1660 manuscript, the verses teaching these extra asanas are said to be by this little marginal... Well, actually, one of them is in the text and the other one's in the margin. It says that one's by... Four of them are attributed to Mohanadasa and three to Lakshmanadasa, so it's Vaishnava names. now... not much more to go. I'm now going to turn away from text to the practical tradition. Now, there's a very famous Ramanandi who lived in the 16th century called Krishnadas Payohari, the Krishnadas, who lived off milk, and he seems to have been a very pivotal figure in the formation of the Ramanandi sect, and his exploits in places as far-flung as Jaipur, Pindar in northern Punjab, and Kulu are still retold by Ramanandis as lots of ashrams that he's meant to have set up. And he was and is renowned as a great yogi, and the verses describing him in the Bhaktamal, back from about 1600, say that he was a master of yoga, he defeated death, that he was urdhvaretas, so this idea of the semen going upwards, normally a corollary of the practice of yoga. Despite this, in a recent book, David White recounts the legend, as one of his best-known legends of Peoharidji, is that he ousted a bunch of narts from a temple of Gultaji just outside Jaipur. But David White, illustrating the lack of awareness of the existence of non-Shaiva yogis that has characterised the study of yoga and yogis, he calls Peoharidji a non-yogi, whereas all the hagiography, all it says about him is what an amazing yogi he was, and then there's a distinct lineage of tapasi, so tapas ascetics who practice yoga that came from him within the Ramanandi tradition. Now, of the same lineage as Peoharidji, is on the left here's a Ramanandi yogi I spent a lot of time with, called Bal Yogi Sri Ram Balakdas, who's been a yogi since he was 10, and on his right that's his guru, Prahlad Das Ji Maharaj. And Balakdas knows a variety of, this picture's about 20 years old, I think, just before Prahlad Das Ji died. But Balak Das knows a variety of Hatha yogic practices, including the infamous Vajroli Mudra, which he learned at the hands, literally, of his guru. And his guru was also a renowned Hatha yogi, meant to have mastered all Vajroli Mudra, obviously Khetri Mudra, and also, according to Balak Das, at least three times he performed Kaya Kalp, which is where you go into an underground chamber and stay in the dark for a month, and he would eat only the oil of bael seeds, and then apparently you reappear with your body renewed. Now, and he learned, his guru who taught him Hatha Yoga was this Devraha Baba, who was a very famous sadhu in North India, who again died around 1990. He lived generally on the banks of the Yamuna in this raised machan. And pop star, with sort of movie stars and politicians would come, and he'd bless them by throwing things at them or touching their heads with his feet. But he's meant to, whenever you read anything about him, he's meant to have lived to 300 years. But he's also said to be 11th in line from Ramanuja. He's definitely of the Ramanuja Sri Vaishnava tradition. So here we have a living Vaishnava Hatha Yoga tradition that traces itself back to a similar milieu to that in which the Dattatreya Yoga Shastra was written. And now I'm going to turn just quickly mention the progenitor of the most influential strand of modern yoga, where we see a similar situation obtains. So it's Tirumalai Krishnamacharya, the teacher of yoga at the Mysore Palace in the 20s and 30s. Was the guru of several teachers who have been responsible for making yoga the global phenomenon it is today. And Krishnamacharya was a Sri Vaishnava. His great-grandfather was head of the Sri Barakala Mata in Mysore, as were and are many of his students. They were also Sri Vaishnavas, including BKS Iyengar. And then there's Madhavadasji, who was the guru of two other yogis who have contributed greatly to the formation of modern yoga, namely Sri Yogendra and Swami Kubalayananda. He was Sri Vaishnava as well. So even if, as Mark Singleton has shown recently in the book Yoga Body, much of the asana practice developed by the students of Krishnamacharya in particular was a 20th century innovation, they were heirs to an old tradition of Hatha Yoga practice. And then finally, by way of a final illustration of the antiquity and continuity of the Vaishnava yoga tradition, I'd like to note here that the Vaikhanasa Smarta Sutra, which is a pretty old Vaishnava work on Dharma, which has been dated to between the 4th and 8th centuries, includes in its prescriptions and descriptions of the practices of ascetics. An eightfold yoga, sitting down between five fires, remaining in a pot of water, sitting in virasana, maintaining silence, inverting the body, standing on one leg, and meditating on Vishnu with bhakti devotion. And so all these practices are typical of today's Ramanandi Tyagis. To conclude, I want to repeat that I am not arguing for specifically Vaishnava origins for Hatha Yoga, or yoga more broadly conceived, but I am saying, firstly, that it is wrong to claim that Hatha Yoga was a specifically Shaiva or Shak tradition that was co-opted by others, and secondly, that the role of Vaishnavas in its development and practice has been greatly overlooked, indeed undeservedly dismissed in scholarship so far.